Hi, this is Carol Baskin. Welcome to the Cat Chat Show. Today we are here with Doug Raleigh. He's the author of Shiloh's True Nature. And the reason that I thought our Cat Chat Show guests might enjoy this book is because it covers a topic that, of course, is very near and dear to our hearts, which is the issue of cub handling, people paying to pose with cubs, and roadside zoos. And I think you'll be kind of surprised to hear how far ahead of his time Doug was. So I wonder, Doug, could you read to our group the section of your book that talks about some of this?
Sure. You'd like me to do that now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that might let everybody know right off the bat why they would want to buy this book.
Okay. Just give me a second here. Okay. Well, just some background on where it is in the book. Shiloh, the main character, is off on a little adventure with a Native American gentleman by the name of Crow. And Crow isn't very talkative at this point. They don't know each other very well. So Shiloh begins asking him a series of questions. And so basically that's where we're going to pick it up. It says, let me see. Crow squinted and said, "The ways of my people have been corrupted over time, Shiloh. They have forsaken the customs of their ancestors. For me, there's no clearer example of that than when I reached the age of ascension. It was then I developed a unique connection to nature. In the distant past, having such a connection would have been looked upon as a tremendous gift. It should have been celebrated, but instead it made me an outcast." Crow then stood up and began walking. Shiloh followed, asking, "What do you mean a connection to nature?" "Well, I can communicate with animals," Crow revealed. Shiloh chuckled. "So what, you can talk to cats and dogs and birds?" Crow let out a little laugh. "Not exactly. It's more like seeing and exchanging thoughts with them." "Wow, that's pretty cool," Shiloh responded. He thought for a moment before saying, "There's one thing I don't understand, though. Why would your ability make you an outcast?" The frown returned to Crow's face. "In the past, my people thought a connection to nature was one of the most important things in life. Today, however, they are like most people, concerned with making money and buying things. They've decided to consume with nature instead of communing with it. They no longer care about the powers and miracle of life, and that's unfortunate. I'm an outcast because my gift reminds them of how they turn their backs on their ancestors." The irritation in Crow's voice was evident, but Shiloh couldn't keep himself from asking, "What are the powers and miracles of life?" Crow kept walking, only smiling at Shiloh without answering. Shiloh shrugged his shoulders. "Can you give me an example or something?" Crow chuckled. "You know, I can, and it's an example you, above all others, will be able to appreciate." Shiloh frowned slightly, but was intrigued by Crow's assertion. "A few years back, I was traveling down south one summer, and came across a sign in front of an old run-down house that read, 'Get your picture taken with a tiger for $10. At the time, I was on a muddy road in a marshy area and thought it must be a joke or something. As I passed a beat-up old shack, I could see an enclosure, a rusty cage by a thicket at the rear of the property. The cage appeared to be empty, but something drew me to it, a feeling of hunger. As I got closer, my chest grew heavy and I struggled for air. When I reached the chain and locked gate of the enclosure, all I found was what appeared to be a dirty, old, rolled-up carpet lying in the back-shaded corner. I turned to leave, but looked over my shoulder one last time to see two eyes staring at me. I was shocked when I realized the dirty carpet wasn't a floor covering at all, but a large cat of some kind, covered in dirt and mud, and the poor thing was so thin I could see just about every bone in its body. I then realized it was a tiger that was being starved, kept weak so it wouldn't escape, and could be used for taking pictures." Shiloh gasped, "That's awful." Crow scowled and said, "It's disgraceful, it's despicable, it's a crime against nature." I was so angry, I didn't know what to do. I wanted to scream, I wanted to find the person who had done this, and find out what gave them the right to possess such a creature, much less abuse it the way they had. "So what did you do?" Shiloh asked.
Now, I love that you left it right there, because everybody's going to have to buy the book to find out what happened next. But there were so many things about just this little section of the book that really blew me away and were the reasons why I thought you might want to learn more about Doug Raleigh today. And first of all, of course, is the whole notion of how wrong it is to be using these wild animals as props for photos. And this book just came out. It just became available, but I understand you wrote it a while back.
Yes, it's been a long time in the making. I actually began, I think it was in 2007, sometime in the summer, and I started just compiling ideas. Well, to give you the full story, I'd have to go back even further.
Please do. But,
oh, okay. Well, originally what I thought I was going to do is when I, you know, what I wanted to do for a living was I thought I wanted to teach. So I thought, I thought I would teach at the collegiate level. So I thought I would get a PhD and go on and be a professor, and I would write books, mostly philosophical dissertations, that sort of thing. But eventually, after I got my master's degree in philosophy, life sort of pushed me in another direction, and that all sort of fell by the wayside. But it was a couple of years ago, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I realized I wasn't going to teach, I thought, well, you know, I still would love to write. So I thought that, I would give it a try. And when I did, the results were disastrous. So I kind of just stepped back from it for a little while. And then a few years later, I decided to give it another try. And when I did, I started compiling various mythologies that have, you know, over the last couple thousand, 3,000 years, all these mythologies from Western cultures and Eastern cultures, and just started to pick out the ones that I enjoyed the most. So back in 2007, I started putting all these together and trying to get together a cogent story. And at that point was, I really had all these wonderful ideas, but I didn't really have an idea as to how I was going to put it all together. So I came across the books from a man by the name of Joseph Campbell. And Campbell wrote two wonderful books called The Power of Myth and The Hero with a Thousand Faces. So particularly the latter was basically an entire blueprint for me as to how to formulate a story. So I took all of these stories or all these mythologies I had and started putting them all together. And that took, I think the outline took me about two and a half years to take the mythologies and put them all into an outline. And basically what I did was I started and I just wrote like a one-page outline saying this is what I wanted to happen. And then I just kept increasing the size, and I did that 9 or 10 times. By the time I finished, the outline was 50,000 words, I think. So something in that. And then by the time I got done with that, then it was – basically, I took the outline and just started converting it over to book form. It was, okay, well, this is what I want to happen here. So I had to describe it in terms that people would appreciate. It's instead of being a book report, it turned into a novel. So it took about five years or so to write, and then with publication and searching for an agent and finding a publisher, it's been 7 years in the making.
Wow. And you know, what really impresses me about that is that you were so far ahead of your time in understanding the issue of these pay-to-play situations for big cats, because back in 2010, there were so many stupid reports in the newspapers and magazines and television where the media was promoting that as, oh, this is a wonderful opportunity and you should go do it and it's saving tigers in the wild and all kinds of nonsense. And we were dumbfounded that people were that ignorant, but we really launched a huge campaign to try and educate people about why that was so cruel to constantly be breeding these cubs and taking them away from their mothers and using them for photo ops, and then they end up relegated to these awful tourist traps and roadside zoos and backyard cages and basements and just horrible situations. And yet you had already figured that out on your own and had incorporated it into your book, and this would have been by 2010, you had already figured that out. So I was very impressed by that, and I was also impressed by even just kind of a turn of the phrase when you said he felt a hunger calling him to the cage. And that's something that anybody who has a deep connection to animals or to nature knows what that feeling feels like. It's like you know there's something out there and it keeps drawing you toward it, but you couldn't nail that to any one of your regular senses. So I'm kind of curious how you, if you remember, how you even came to use that phrase in that way.
Well, I want to jump back a second. The reason I know about this at all is because of Big Cat Rescue. So that's why it's in the book.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know any of this. My wife has been visiting Big Cat Rescue for years. So, you know, she told me about it, and I've researched it, and most of it is because of you. So you're the reason that it's in the book, for one.
Oh, thank you.
And for two, another reason that I think of this as happening, just to get this out, is that people seem to think that big cats are just large house cats, and they need to know that that is not the case. I know I'm preaching to the choir on this one. Anybody who's watching this probably gets that already. What you were saying about the media, and they fill people's heads and make it sound like, oh, they're just big kitties. They are not. They are completely different, and that's something that people really need to know. Now, as far as how I came across the exact wording, it was just trying to, when I was writing that sequence, I was just trying to make it as powerful as possible so that when people read it, it would make them feel something. I know for me and most of the people who've read it, I don't know if outrage is the right word, or it's just aggravating, and you just know it's wrong.
I think outrage is pretty good.
Yeah, well, I just want people to have that feeling of that it's wrong, and that they should know it's wrong, and for people to take action, they need to be informed, first of all, and they need something that provokes them into action. And I'm hoping that this is what, if anyone who reads this will do, will feel that way and think that, hey, you know what, this is wrong. Does this really happen? They'll investigate it, find out either from you or from other sources that it does happen, and then they'll do something that maybe they, you know, contact their congressman or their senator or their state legislators to try to see that this type of thing doesn't happen anymore.
Absolutely. You know, there was another phrase in there too that just took my breath away, because I've never, in 30 years of rescuing big cats, I've never heard anybody say it this way, and it's probably the most powerful and most accurate description for the horrible condition that I see so many of these cats in. And that was when you referred to the tiger as, or you said that the tiger was mistakenly looked like a rolled up dirty carpet. And we just rescued some tigers from New York, and that is exactly what comes to mind when you would look at these cats. They had bones protruding in every direction and ragged, filthy fur barely clinging to those bones. And when they would lay down, that's exactly what they looked like, was a old, dirty carpet. And yet I've never said that. I've never heard anybody say that. And when I read it in your book, I was just like, that's it. That's exactly what that cat looked like. So I'm curious how, if you've never seen a cat in that kind of condition, how you could even envision that so accurately.
In the writing process, I sometimes will toil over how to describe and how to convey something, because when I write, I have an idea in my head, and I know what it looks like, I know what it's supposed to look like, and trying to get it out from brain to paper or computer or whatever doesn't always work out really well. But sometimes I will take forever just to sit down and try and get a line right or get an idea right. And, you know, I'd love to tell you some great story as to why it is that I came up with that particular description, but that's what it I imagined. It just came out of my head, pretty much. That's what I imagined they would look like if I was in that situation.
Well, that's exactly what it would look like. You had talked a little bit about the process of writing a book, and I know an awful lot of the people, for some reason, who watch this show are actually interested in publishing their own works, and some of them are very far along. I know one of them is getting really close to launching her book, and others are just, you know, thinking, wow, that would be fun. What did you learn over... You said that you had a bad experience with it and then kind of put it aside and then you came back to it. Can you kind of take us through that evolution of what made you want to come back to it and what maybe you did different the second time?
Well, the first time I was a little naive in what it is I was trying to accomplish. I thought that it would just be, oh, I'm just going to sit down and write something and then I'll be able to make a living. It doesn't work that way. You really have to understand your subject matter, what you're doing. Even if you're able to write well, you need to be a reader as well. You need to read things that are in your same genre. You know, if you want to write a spy novel, then you need to read spy novels. If you want to write a fantasy, you have to read fantasy work. So my initial thing was I sat down, I'm just going to write and I'm going to do this, and oh, it was terrible. The results were terrible. And, you know, you don't want to tell yourself that. You want to stay positive. So, basically, you lie to yourself. You say, oh, it's not that bad. But eventually, I came to the conclusion that it was terrible. And then I took another shot without actually addressing the problems. And the results were a little better. But then I just sort of, well, you know, I'm not sure whether I'm cut out for this. But then in the meantime, I went back to reading. So I'm reading and I'm getting a better grasp of the direction that I wanted to go. It wasn't prior to this, I hadn't thought about what it took to write a book. It was, oh, I'm just going to do it. Well, that's, you know, the enthusiasm is wonderful, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to achieve what it is you need to. I mean, you know, a baseball player doesn't get to hit a fastball by just walking up to the plate. You need to practice. So... I just look at the first two novels as, you know, a learning experience. And when I did it the second time, I wanted to make sure that I had a complete outline and that I was going to convey everything in a way that I wanted it. Like you had said about the whole thing about the dirty rolled up carpet. I don't remember at the time, but I know there were sections of the book where I toiled for a week over a simple paragraph. Just wanting to convey something and to have you be able to read it and see in your head what I'm seeing in mine, it's very hard to do. So as far as any, you know, as far as how someone would get to that point or what they would need to do is they need to read and a lot and make sure that they are well versed in what it is they're writing about. And, just they need to do their best to make sure that they're saying what it is they want to say. And I think in the long run they'll be happy with their work if they do that.
Did you go back to college between the first two books and the third book?
No. No.
So the history and the philosophy that you had studied was prior to your writing experience?
Yes.
And that's really heavy stuff to be conveying in such a easy to read manner. Just from that little section that you read, you can tell that it's a very, it's an easy book to read. Was that by design?
Yes. Well, it was aimed at the, you know, teenage, young adult, genre in that age group. But, I wanted to make it accessible for everyone. Well, let me back up. When I was in college and I was getting my master's, some of the, like, if you tried to read anything, you get a headache trying to read Wittgenstein or Kant or anything of that nature. So it could be very taxing for someone who's not familiar with it, and it was very almost, I don't want to say painful, but some of the things you would try to read were very difficult. Now, some of the things that I came across that were very entertaining was like Sartre and Kierkegaard, where they would tell stories. and they would convey philosophical concepts in that regard. So I thought, or when I was writing this, I thought that I could do that with this book. And I did it in various regards. I mean, the story of the cats is just one little piece of something that I wanted to get in there, a philosophy. It shouldn't be, you should just know, there should be innate right and wrong in people. And when you, that finding those, the cats in those situations, you just know it's wrong. So I think I wanted to convey that and get that feeling into people, that they would read it and they just know it's wrong. So.
And are there similar other stories in the book that give you that same opportunity to kind of suss out right from wrong?
I think in the long run, yeah. I can tell you this, the main character has issues, like minor flaws. And I think that's what makes a great protagonist, a great character, is someone who isn't perfect, someone who you can relate to, and you can, and we do that by relating to people's flaws. And I don't think I'll be giving too much away to say that in the book, Shiloh has a tremendous fear of heights. So there are little things in there that I try to convey to that, how he gets through that sort of thing. So now, is that something major? No, but it, if someone who has a fear of heights reads it, they might say, oh, well, you know, maybe I could focus elsewhere, so I don't worry about this, or don't let it bother me, something that affects people. So that's just one little thing, but I think in the long run, there's a lot of philosophical concepts in there, along with many mythologies.
I love to watch people. I'm sort of a recluse, so I'd love to do it from under a rock, but I love to sit in a roadside cafe and have people walking down the sidewalk, and as I watch them, I try to feel, what would it be like to be that person, and what kind of things are they dealing with today, and imagining their entire life kind of gelling from just this one very brief encounter. And I'm wondering if you, as a writer, do you get inspiration for some of your characters by seeing somebody and doing that kind of imagining, or do you just sit in a room and imagine the character and their personality and all of what makes them who they are? How do you get that inspiration?
Well, my philosophical area of expertise was existentialism, so as you can imagine, I spent a lot of time thinking about what it means to exist. So as far as the characters, mostly I when I was coming up with the ideas for the story, it would be a lot of pacing and listening to music and just trying to come up with ideas that I felt passionate about and that I hoped others would feel the same way about. But I don't think that I actually sat down and said, okay, well, you know, I want this person to present this moral type of behavior throughout. It was more of a morality by example or by action than specifically thinking, okay, well, I want them to be this particular way.
Wow, that's interesting. I'm always interested in how different people's brains work. When you completed this book, what did you go through to get it published?
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, all right. Well, as I mentioned, I actually started writing the book, or I started compiling the notes for it in 2007. I actually finished it in May of 2010. So it was at that point somewhere, that was the first draft was done then. But I started immediately trying to find agents because I had known from my prior experiences that it might take a little time. So I started, and I think I wrote to 50, 60 agents or so. And
oh, wow.
I would say half of them didn't get back to me at all. The ones that did had no interest. And then I started, now this took place over the course of 6 months or a year or so. So then my next phase was, I had read online somewhere, I can't remember, but it was a some author's website, and they had said that they had indicated that for a first-time author, the best way, route to go is to actually just find a publisher on your own. Or actually, I think the way they phrased it was, it's easier to find an agent once you already are published than it is to find one prior to getting published. Which
that seems counterintuitive.
Yeah, you'd think so, but anyway, so then I started searching for publishers, and I would write to them. Wrote to countless publishers, I don't even remember, another 50 or 60, and it was somewhere in the spring of 2012 that I heard from Hobbs End.
And wow, 2 years later.
Yeah.
Dang.
And they were very upbeat, they were very positive, they had nothing but wonderful things to say, they absolutely loved the book. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if that's the case, I guess nobody else actually even bothered to read it. So it was wonderful. They were just, you know, 100% positive, but then it took another 2 years to actually get out. So, long process.
I've been interviewing for a position that we have available here for a media producer, and one of the people, as part of their resume, submitted a script that they had written for television. If you were to try and take your book to a television audience, would you be the one to try and produce a script that would convey it?
Well, you know, I think it probably would translate well, because that's the way I see it initially in my head. It's a movie in my head that I'm trying to already tell to the reader. And that's why sometimes it drives me crazy. It takes a couple of weeks or something, a ridiculous amount of time to write something very, you know, a page, because I'm trying to make sure that I'm conveying what it is I'm seeing in my head. I don't know. I guess I could probably translate it, but if it was to be successful, I'd rather have someone who had been very successful at it beforehand.
I was really surprised when I was reading the script, because it sounded like somebody describing a movie set, you know, the sunlight was filtering through the window, and all of those mm-hmm. kinds of things were setting up the very basic next pieces of dialogue, and there was so much more description of what that scene looked like than there was of what was happening in that scene, that I thought, man, that's a whole different thing to try and attack.
Well, yeah, it's if you're converting to a script, you're basically writing down what it is you're hoping the director will actually do, so that it closely matches what it is that is on the page. So you say, okay, you want this to happen, you want this to happen, you want this to happen, you want this person to say this. So I don't know. It seems like it would be a lot of work, but it could be a lot of fun too.
What are your next plans coming up?
I'm currently working on the second novel in the series. Yes. I'm figuring it's going to take 4 or 5 to finish this entire storyline.
Four or five years?
Oh, no, 4 or 5 books.
Okay.
Four or 5 years. It'll be that by the time the next book gets out.
Shiloh will be like 50.
Right, exactly. So it's, you know, if it's going to be made into movies, they're going to have to wait till it's all done, because, you know, you hire some kid early on and they're 30 by the time the last one gets published. I'm working on the second one. It was the same process as last time. While I was in the torturous process of finding an agent and a publisher for this one, I began compiling notes, putting together the storyline for the second one. Actually, I know how it all is going to go. It's just that I have a manila folder that's about this thick with things that I would have scribbled down and just throw notes in there, and I have to find the ones that go with which story. So,
wow.
Yeah, I had to pull all those out, and I had to compile the second story, and basically, again, the outline was about 50,000 words, and then I started writing it here in the last 6 months, and it's been slow going because I've been, you know, focused on doing things for the publication of True Nature, and, you know, with work and life and everything else. So it's slow going, but I'm working on it.
Speaking of that, when do you even find time to write?
You know, it's when I wrote the first one, it was all at night. Everything was done. I would say 90% of it was written after midnight, where everything nice and quiet, No movement outside, just, I used to think, oh, you know, I could write better, I could focus better late at night, nobody, and there's no noise. And that worked for me for the first book, but the second one, I've been writing most of it during the daylight hours, so I don't really have a, you know, I squeeze in the time when I can. I mean, I feel guilty if I have free time and I don't work on it, but I also don't want to force myself either, because if I do, then I find out that later on I don't like what I wrote. So I do it when I feel like I'm motivated to.
It sounds like that would really make sense, because otherwise it's just time wasted.
Well, yeah, exactly. You force yourself to do something, and you just, you know, you're not it's not going to have the results that you want. It's not going to sound the way you wanted it to.
What advice would you give to budding authors?
Thick skin and tenacity. Just don't take the rejection personally, because I wonder half the time if any of them actually even looked at it, whether it was publishers or agents. And then as far as, just keep at it, just keep writing and just keep working on what it is. I think, honestly, life is about doing what you love, you know, making yourself happy. And so if you love to write, just keep writing and just keep trying to get published. And eventually, if you pour your heart into it and you have enough skill, somebody's going to recognize that, and hopefully you'll be successful at it.
It sounds like after you got that first one under your belt that was published, that it really emboldened you to go ahead and start. Well, maybe I've got that wrong, because you were saying that you were writing the second one before you got that one published, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so you were pretty confident that this was going to go. You just didn't see that evidence of it yet.
No, I wasn't confident that it was going to get published. I hoped it would, and I was preparing for it too. So, you know, and that's the thing. This story stands on its own, all by itself. If somebody picks it up, there's a start, there's a finish, there's a resolution. However, in the long run, it's part of a larger series. And just like the second book that I'm writing now, I'm making sure, that's one of the reasons why the first few chapters have taken me so long, is I'm trying to make sure that I'm filling in enough detail so that they don't have to go back and read the first one. It would be nice if they did, and they would enjoy it. However, if someone happens to pick up the second one when it's done and published, they won't be lost.
That's a great idea, because you never know where people are going to come into your life. I know we certainly see that from our videos and our website, that you never know what of those 9,700 pages are going to land on first, so it better make sense wherever they land. For the people who are not going to see the show notes on our website, I will post on our show notes page where they can buy this book, but some people will probably only hear this as they're driving in their car. Where can they buy Shiloh's True Nature?
Well, right now, it is only available, or exclusively available, at Amazon. So they can go to Amazon.com and put in either Shiloh's True Nature or D.W. Raleigh, and that should bring it up. And Raleigh is like North Carolina. The capital, North Carolina.
And if you go to smile.amazon.com and then do that search, Big Cat Rescue will get a portion of the proceeds, and it doesn't cost you any more, and it doesn't take any money away from Doug and his publisher. Well, this has been so nice of you. I really appreciate it. And for those who don't know, we tried to do this a week ago, and I made a terrible mistake and didn't manage to get any of this copied to tape, so I appreciate you giving us a second chance to try and get this out to everybody, because I think it's a very important message, and I think people who love cats are going to love this, and people who love a good story are going to love this.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You are quite welcome. So everyone, until next week, this has been the Cat Chat Show. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a 4-star rating, or to Stitcher Radio and do the same thing so that others can find us. And now these shows are available on Roku. If you have a Roku box, you can go to the channel store and look for Big Cat Rescue, or type in BCR, and it's a free channel. Has all of our great videos, has all of our long-form videos, has all of our cat chat videos, and our vet videos. All of them are there as different series that you can watch for free. So until next time, thank you very much. Bye-bye.